In honor of Women's History Month, I'm going to give a shout out today to an educator from the great state of Texas, Rita Pearson. She gave a TED Talk called Every Kid Needs a Champion. Here she is on the TED stage talking about kids.
Every child deserves a champion, an adult who will never give up on them, who understands the power of connection and insists that they become the best that they can possibly be.
From First Focus on Children, this is Speaking of Kids. I'm Bruce Leslie.
And I'm Estella Chalupi. Speaking of Kids is a podcast that puts kids at the center of public policy.
We have an absolute powerhouse for a guest today.
We sure do. She is on fire.
More on her in a minute, Ms. Alich. What are we talking about today?
Today we get into moms, families, the child tax credit, and all the other things that come in those early years of a kid's life. You know, these really invisible forces that can dramatically shape a kid's life and one of an entire family.
You know, when we think about all the things that kids need, it's champions throughout their childhood. And so it starts at birth with their parents and their grandparents and their pediatricians and the OBGYN. And it just moves on from there to childcare workers and early childhood professionals and teachers and coaches. And it really gets back to Rita Pearson's quote, which is that every child does deserve a champion and multiple champions, in fact.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm all for having a whole team, you know, surrounding a child. And I know as a mama bear, it oftentimes, like you said, Bruce, it starts with, you know, a mom. And that's what, you know, I love so much about our guest today is when you become a mom or, and a parent too, Bruce, you have four little ones, but are big ones now, actually. But, you know, it really starts with a mom, you know, and just how much it changes your life when you become a mom and how much you want to protect. And then you start to pay attention to the system and you realize that that system is not always set up and designed to support families.
What we know is that when we think about advocacy, you know, kids also need those same types of supports. And so one of the great things is, you know, there's groups like ours who advocate for kids, but then there's, you know, groups that our guest today represents, which is Moms Rising, and they bring the perspective of the moms and their advocacy for kids. And so those things come together in really important ways. They've been just such tremendous partners to us on child and family policy and advocacy.
Yes, oftentimes it takes somebody that has run into some issues and really needs to reach out to get support. And when you start that process, that's when you start to realize how it works or doesn't work.
Yeah. Today, our guest is Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner. She's the co-founder and executive director of Moms Rising.
Yes, Moms Rising is an organization with over 1 million members at the forefront of addressing vital issues affecting women, mothers, and families. They educate the public and mobilize grassroots efforts to connect women's voices with leaders at all levels of government. They also hold corporations accountable for fair treatment and product safety.
Kristen, thanks so much for joining us today on this Speaking of Kids podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for being here with us. And, you know, we just kind of want to start with, we recognize you've been in public policy and advocacy and politics for over 2 decades. And, you know, what really drew you to the cause of children and moms and families?
So much drew me to this cause. So it's hard for me not to answer with like 8 or 10 hours of boring experiences, but these experiences aren't boring. I mean, the biggest thing that drew me is that the experiences that I had as a new mom are experienced by so many people across the country. And so I'll share a little bit about my experience. But the big thing is that when this many people are having the same types of struggle at the same time, I realized we don't have an epidemic of personal failures. It's not individual moms, dads, parents, caregivers' fault. We have a national structural crisis that we can and must solve together. So what happened to me? I was raised by a mom who was primarily single through my childhood and had always planned to be able to stay in the labor force after I had my kids, to help put that food on the table, to be self-reliant, you know, to be able to have that security, economic security. And then my son was born, and he was born with a primary immune deficiency. We had an unplanned health crisis. And I also had some health crisis. My immune system and his were not friendly, shall we say. And so in that moment, I didn't have any paid family medical leave. And again, I was not alone. The United States of America has no national paid family medical leave program, even though the majority of countries on the actual planet Earth have this policy in place because it lifts our economy, it lifts our families, it lifts our country, it lifts our businesses, it saves lives, it saves taxpayer dollars. I could go on again for 500 hours about the benefits of this type of policy, which is why every other country almost has it. But in this moment, I was pushed out of the labor force. Like hundreds of thousands of parents are pushed out of the labor force every year. And I was depressed. I was lonely. I was dealing with an infant with this unplanned health crisis that I did not know how to deal with. So I was in like an extreme learning curve. And I did what any normal person does. I called the U.S. Census. This is who I call for help, people. The U.S. Census. It's like, who are you going to call? The U.S. Census. Why? I wanted to know if I was alone. I wanted to know what was happening. I knew that if this experience had happened to my mom, who was, again, single for most of my childhood, it would have been an outright disaster. Because when you're pushed out of the labor force, you also lose your job-linked health care. You also have an incredible struggle being able to pay for childcare when you can get maybe back into the labor force because childcare costs more than college. It's like the dominoes of doom in the United States of America when you have a kid without any kind of care infrastructure that actually allows everyone to work, to live, and to rise. And so I called the U.S. Census and I was like, what is going on? And they said, we don't know. Because we do not track unremunerated or unpaid labor. Mm. We can tell you what's happening to parents who are married by looking at the shadow of the unpaid person in the married spouse's salary. And they said, we can tell you that you're 7 times as likely to live in poverty if you are out of the labor force having kids, which, you know, sometimes people think of stay-at-home moms as sitting by the pool eating bonbons. But in fact, the opposite is the case. So this is my long story of it was that moment, that wake-up call, both with my own experience, with my mother's experience, and with calling the U.S. Census of all places, that I realized, A, I'm not alone. B, we have a crisis. And C, it is a solvable crisis because we together have the power to solve these crises that we face. It doesn't take rocket science. Again, most other countries have these policies in place. Many states have these policies in place. We know how to solve these problems. We just need the political capital and power and push, consistent, persistent push to bring them over the finish line. So that's my long 500-hour story.
I love that.
And as I recall, you all started around the same time the First Focus was created. What made you think about creating your own nonprofit around the issues of moms? And why did you do that? Like, why did you think there was a need for that?
Oh, this is also an overly long story. I got to learn how to say these things more concise. So when I called the U.S. Census, I went down this rabbit hole, continuing the story. And I started writing about these policy areas. I started writing about what's happening with parents in America. I started writing about, you know, why have we ignored what's happening with care? And what's the history behind that? I wrote a couple books. I wrote a lot of articles. And one of the books I wrote, I co-wrote with Joan Blade, called The Motherhood Manifesto. Mm. And it was also turned into a documentary film that was aired all over the place. And resources were coming in from the book and from the film. And Joan Blades, who I co-founded Moms Rising with, also co-founded Move On. I had been working in the environmental movement, doing political work. So we had a lot of political experience. And so we looked at each other and we were like, there's no one that we could see opening avenues at that time for the voices of moms to be heard by people who have the power to make the changes we seek, need, that reflect our contributions and our needs. We first did a survey of about 6 groups, and we said, who's doing this, opening avenues for moms' voices to be heard on care? And by the way, 86% of women in America have kids by the time they're 44 years old, so this is not a small group of people. And the 6th group said, we don't know. So we went to 12 groups. They said, nope, nobody here. Eventually did a survey of 48 groups, you know, who's opening avenues in this particular area for the voices of moms to be heard in partnership with moms. And Then, finally, with the blessing of those first 48 groups, we started Moms Rising with the revenue from the book and the film. And our first house party, we were super lucky. So we had house parties across America looking at the film, discussing these topics, talking about politics. Our first house party was actually held in the Russell Building of Congress. And the co-sponsors, this is really interesting history, of the house party were Senator Barack Obama, Senator Clinton, Senator Dodds, and Senator Kennedy. And three of those four went on to run for president in the next, like, so it was a really good, strong beginning, but, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I love your story, Kristen. Nothing helps frame and reorient your mind than becoming a mother and a parent. I have three of my own, and I've had the privilege of working at First Focus now almost 11 years. And I also serve on the board of an organization called District Motherhood that really focuses Black motherhood and just the journey. And there's not enough attention that's drawn to the shifts that take place. You know, one question I have for you now is, like, you know, we're living in this crazy new reality. That's our world post-COVID, a lot of things going on in the Beltway that too many to name. But what really keeps you up at night, you know, now being an election year? You know, we've been around, both Moms Rising and First Focus have been around nearly 20 years. A lot of the issues that we're working on remain the same. And it's not rocket science, you know, and I always make the argument that this is a national security issue. You know, centering children and families should be a top priority of the U.S. government. But what keeps you up at night?
So many things keep me up at night. One of the things that's happening in America right now that keeps me up at night is the level of targeted disinformation that is aimed at moms in particular by the MAGA extremist Republican contingent is so high. It's so pervasive and it's so damaging. And so we know, just to give a little history of why that's happening and what happened. When Donald Trump lost the White House, he said, with Steve Bannon saying this publicly, even to NPR, that the way back to the White House was through the school boards because they're angling at those 76 million mom voters in the United States of America to pit mom voters against one another, use disinformation of the most ridiculous, hateful, harmful kind to grab votes. And we've seen that happening. We've seen that happening over and over again. So what keeps me up at night is, what is the impact of this disinformation? Often when you're receiving disinformation, you don't know it, right? Like, it's actually quite effective. And so I'm going to share the positive because I have to. That's my gut. And one of the positives is that in the last election, the Moms Against Liberty, I can't say Moms for Liberty, I'll just say it, Moms Against Liberty, of their 130 endorsed races that they did at the school board level, they lost 70%. And they lost 70% because people woke up to the disinformation. They woke up to the harm that's happening in their communities because of, you know, the push for book bans, for censorship, for pushing out engaged communities and families. Like, not okay, people, not okay. But it's going to get weirder before we get to November. It's going to get more toxic and more harmful. And that has impacts not just in what we think, but in the culture around us. And what we're thinking about, you know, basically nihilism and democracy and, you know, how hopeful we all are. And one of the really big pieces of disinformation that keeps me up at night right now is the disinformation that's being pushed out that people are checked out, locked out, apathetic, and disengaged. And I just want to stand here with all of you and share, because I know you're seeing the opposite too. At Moms Rising, we're seeing double the on-the-ground turnout than expected right now. People are not checked out. We just have over 6,500 get out the vote volunteers already stepped forward. We're not even asking for them yet for November. You know, we're expecting over 70,000 get out the vote volunteers. So what keeps me up at night is that, in particular, the communities that we work with every day, because we are so politically powerful and numerous, are being targeted by the far right with some really yucky stuff aimed again at pitting us against each other and a vote grab. What gives me hope is what we've done together. Together, we not only, for example, helped pass the Affordable Care Act. Hello, hello, hello. But also protected it more than 50 times, even when people said we couldn't protect it. You know, recently we passed the Pregnant Workers Fairness Act, the Pump for Nursing Mothers Act, 1 year full healthcare coverage for postpartum people in states that take it up, you know, and more. There's a lot of hope in what we've done together. So for listeners who are wondering, how do I tell the difference between disinformation and information, knowing it's about to get weirder? Here is a big clue. If it's hateful, if it's mean, if it's harmful, if it's not supporting kids, parents, teachers, caregivers, then double, triple check the source. And when we're talking about this, we're not just talking about MAGA Republicans. We are in a level 23 out of 10 level situation here with the disinformation. It's been reported to the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee that we're talking about foreign nations like China and Russia, just simply trying to dismantle and destabilize our democracy through disinformation pushes. So there's a lot of research going right now on the side of yuck about what will make us, you know, go... And hate is twice as sticky as love in our minds in terms of what we remember. So again, just to all the listeners, I just encourage and hope that when you see hate come across your, you know, social media or your TV and the ads, know that there's a lot of micro-targeting in anything that's hateful. Triple check the source. It's probably disinformation.
I love it. And one shout out is I'm wearing my Love Never Gives Up t-shirt today. But I think you're absolutely right. And I think for people, you know, we kind of can see it in a different lens because we're primed to kind of pick up on the nuances and the language that people use. And being a, you know, money person, I always like to see, well, who's funding this? And then oftentimes when you go down that money trail, it becomes pretty obvious and also pretty scary, right? Like yeah. The level of tentacles that are out there.
That's so true.
Coming up after the break, we'll talk to Kristen more about the money and what's keeping families from getting more of it.
Stick around.
Making the world a better place for all children can seem like an impossibly huge task. Some of you may be thinking, I am just one person. What could I possibly do to make a difference? I'm Leila Nimatala, Vice President of Advocacy and Mobilization at First Focus on Children. And I'm inviting you to join us and become one of our volunteer advocates, whom we call our Ambassadors for Children. Ambassadors are our most active child advocates who raise critical issues with the U.S. Congress and with the administration related to child policy and funding decisions, both for kids in the U.S. and worldwide. But don't take my word for it. We asked one of our ambassadors to share her experience.
I am Katie Landa. I live in New York City. I currently work as a researcher for an institute called the Child and Family Research Center at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I joined the Ambassador Program because it's important to me to participate in working towards public policies that support children and their families. And I would encourage you to become an ambassador if you would like to become a part of a very supportive and warm network of people that values teaching and learning and activism towards creating a more just and caring country. Thank you.
So please join us, won't you? Check out campaignforchildren.org/ambassadors on how to become a First Focus on Children ambassador, and to link up with our fabulous community of committed child advocates.
First Focus on Children is a bipartisan advocacy organization dedicated to making children and families the priority in federal policy and budget decisions.
First Focus on Children moves beyond individual issues to serve a more important role, child advocacy. We educate lawmakers and the American public about the issues facing children.
To learn more about our work and ways that you can become an ambassador, go to firstfocus.org.
Coming up on State of Play, Masalich and I are going to chat about the baby and child penalties and the child tax credit. Kristen, I just wanted to ask you, one thing that's going on right now is we have a child tax credit bill sitting in the United States Senate, and it's languishing, passed the House overwhelmingly. The circumstances surrounding low-income families and childbirth are so numerous and challenging, like complications during pregnancy, the need for bed rest, postpartum issues, and then there's inadequate childcare and family medical leave policies that make things so much harder. So why are we punishing families instead of supporting them?
I love the child tax credit. The economy loves the child tax credit. Businesses love the child tax credit. And parents, of course, love the child tax credit. Poll after poll also shows that family economic security policies like the child tax credit, like paid family medical leave, like affordable child care, like fair pay for child care workers, like elder and disability care, are supported by Democrats, Republicans, Independents, Libertarians, and everybody across the political spectrum by a wide margin. Even 76% of Trump voters support paid family medical leave. So in answer to your question of what's happening, we have a situation where two things are happening. One, the Republican leadership in Washington, D.C., inside the Beltway, is completely out of step with their own Republican constituents at home. And that's why we're seeing states pass these policies first in bipartisan ways. But two, we're also seeing a complete disregard for what builds our economy. It is ridiculous to me that 72% of our GDP is based on consumer spending, that the majority of consumer spending decisions are made by women and moms, over 80%. We fuel the economy. When we don't have money to spend, when we are underpaid, when we don't have the child tax credit, when we have pay discrimination, when we're pushed out of the labor force, literally we all lose out. So it's not even about the child or the individual family. It's really about all of us. And research shows that when any one of us are doing better, we all do better. So it's in all of our best interest for every child to be able to thrive. And the child tax credit is one of those policies that's absolutely proven to be able to do that. We have the receipts. During the pandemic, we had a temporary expansion of the child tax credit to be a monthly payment of about $360 per child per month. And during that time period, we saw people be able to better afford food on the table, better afford a roof over their heads, better afford childcare, better afford stability. And you know what we also saw? We saw the labor force participation of people who are primary caretakers go up because most people need the wages of parents to make ends meet. And we saw a 40% decrease in childhood poverty, the largest single year drop in child poverty in the history of our nation, which, by the way, isn't only about poverty. It's about economic prosperity, because the inverse of child poverty is economic prosperity, because remember, we are the engine of our economy.
Yep.
And so I love the child tax credit, and we helped push the expansion, which isn't enough. Yep. It's not back to where we need to be, through the House, along with you and many other organizations. And as you said, it's languishing in the Senate right now. So everybody call your senator and tell them, vote the child tax credit out of the Senate with no amendments, please and thank you.
Yeah, no amendments is right. So I'm going to take us a different direction for a second and give you a shout out. You know, I really felt like Moms Rising was such a great partner, but also even as an organizational mentor to us. And so one of the things you guys really taught us was, you know, how to develop lists. Really appreciate all that, you know, technical assistance and stuff. But one of the cultural things that we've embraced at First Focus on Children, which comes from you guys, is I loved that you guys have this whole thing where you celebrate wins. I think one of the things we do in this, you know, in our community is we work on something and it passes and we move on to the next thing. And you really do need to celebrate it and really let people know what happened, but also you celebrate losses. Like, and I probably am saying that wrong the way you guys look at it, but I love that you guys embrace, you know, trying new things. And if it doesn't work, it's okay. You tried it and then let's move on. You celebrate it in the way of let's learn what did or did not work there. So anyway, I'd love for you to talk about even the culture that you guys have there, which I think is really interesting. And like I said, it's something that we really have taken from you.
Oh, thank you. Well, we learn a lot from you and we really, really, really appreciate your partnership and your leadership in so many ways. And the fact that 30 million extra people have healthcare because of the Affordable Care Act is in no small part due to your direct work. So thank you. No, as well as the consumer protections, which I could be so excited about and talk about for 5 hours. So thank you to you for your leadership. In terms of trying things, one of the things that we really try to remember is that if this was easy, if solving these problems from a political perspective was easy, we wouldn't be in this situation because we know the policies that we need for a solution. States have tried them. They've turned out great. We've had the policies, as we just noted, temporarily in some places. They've turned out great. The rest of the planet has these policies. They've turned out great. We kind of know what the unintended negative consequences could be from, you know, the policies that we're proposing every day. So it's not about the policies, right? It's about making sure that we're trying lots of different tactics to be heard. Because as we just talked about a second ago, you know, the constituents, Democrats, Republicans, Independent, Libertarian, all support the policies that we work on every day at home. But we have a problem with the leadership in Washington, D.C., the Republican leadership, to be specific, who are standing in the way of these policies moving forward. So you got to try a lot of things. Because if it was easy, it wouldn't work. So we like to try a lot of things for a couple of reasons. One, parents are busy, right? When you have a new baby, many people don't realize the catastrophe that it is to have a baby in America until you have a baby in America. And then you're like, wait a minute, I have no paid family medical leave. Wait a minute, if I was going to save for childcare like I was going to save for college, I would have to start saving when I myself was 7 years old. You know, wait a minute, what the heck is going on here? You know, and it's that moment that you're also juggling learning about a new baby, probably juggling work, you know, juggling all this. So you're busy. So at Moms Rising, we like to have an aggressively welcoming rainbow of partnership with our members, offer lots of different ways that our members can choose to be heard because they're busy. So everything from 30 seconds to like physically going places. At the same time, we know that it's going to take lots of different avenues and pressure points of being heard because our media environment is just chaotic. It's not like we have 3 television shows. We've got a bazillion, you know, internet podcasts, you know, everything happening. So to break through, you need to be breaking through on multiple channels. And we know that as we do this, again, if it was easy, it would have happened already. So a lot of what we're doing is not going to work. So we try to really work quickly and testing out like, okay, are people interested in doing this? Are we heard in this way? And then when it doesn't work, we call a joyful funeral.
Yeah.
We say, okay, let us have a joyful funeral on this tactic. Either nobody liked it or nobody heard us. You know, restart with our creativity. We just had for the CTC, childcare, and WIC a couple weeks ago, we had people dressed up as big hearts outside of the Senate office buildings. And as the senators and their staff were going in and out, we delivered heart candy with the policies written on the candy and with storybooks of our members that also started up with the policy priorities that we're seeking. And we were able to talk to 15 senators themselves in like an hour with moms outside the doors, kind of just like, hey, here we are. At the same time, we also hand delivered to every member of Congress the storybook and policy priorities. And then we also were going on social and other, you know, ways of communicating. And we had chalk drawings all across Washington, D.C. about the policy priorities. So that's an example of lots of things happening at the same time and trying to keep it fun because one of the things that, you know, we're doing, we have over 1 million members. We have members in every state in the nation. To stay engaged, to stay empowered, to stay in partnership, it has to be fun. It's impossible and it's bad for our health, our personal health, to have it be, you know, a heavy negative every day working in these areas. So we also try to do fun things.
That's great.
Kristen, I already know you're going to have an amazing answer to this question. But, you know, we ask all our listeners, you know, we're developing a playlist, our Speaking of Kids playlist. And so, you know, we're when things get hard and when you feel a little discouraged, what's your go-to song or album?
I actually don't have a great answer because I am the most eclectic music listener.
It's okay.
I often will go to the Apple, what are the top things that our people are listening to, and just listen to them straight through. Because sometimes I think what I need to know in my soul is that there's creativity, newness, hope, change on the horizon. And one of the most beautiful things about music is there's creativity, hope, and change. And so I really like hearing the new. I really like hearing what's happening. And so I guess my go-to is to go to the Apple Music top right now and then just dance around the house. I won't lie, I actually do dance around the house.
With three kids, we have dance parties like pretty much every night. And they're awesome. I don't get to control the playlist, but one of my kids is playing DJ. So I love that, Kristen. Again, thank you so much for your time.
Oh my gosh, thanks so much.
Thank you, thank you.
And thanks for your partnership over the years, really. I think more than almost any other partner, we really value our relationship with Moms Rising and have learned so many lessons from you and love your leadership on these topics for moms and kids. So thank you.
Well, thank you. We love your leadership and we love your partnership. And none of us could do it without the other of us. So we so appreciate all you're doing to lift every child, every family in the nation. Thank you so much.
So on our Say to Play today, we're going to talk about our good old friend, the child tax credit, but really hone in on this unique window of time when a mother is pregnant, when the baby first arrives, and that first little bit of time when families are just readjusting. So, you know, Bruce, to your point, and we talk about this in some of our more recent reports, this triple whammy that families suffer between losing income around the birth of a child, and naturally when you have a new child, the increase of costs that come associated with that. And then now in this case, you know, really the reduction in their child tax credit.
The debate around the child tax credit has been really frustrating because what happens is when you have a child, as you said, Sally, like your income drops. You know, by definition, parents go, as we both know only too well, your income drops because you might have to go on bed rest or you're out of the workforce when you're having the baby. And then sometimes there's complications having to do with the birth of a child for either the mom, the baby, or babies, or both. And so consequently, what doesn't make sense is the way the child tax credit works is that because people have tied the child tax credit to income and this whole deservingness and work requirements that people impose, babies and moms get a reduction in their child tax credit for the very reason that they had a baby. And that makes no sense whatsoever. I think nobody would believe that good public policy penalizes people for having a child. This is the moment in time when parents have more needs, not fewer, and yet the child tax credit imposes a penalty.
Bruce, in your opinion, where do you think the disconnect happens? Is it just in the realities of people on the Hill and policymakers making these decisions just being so far removed from these issues and like the realities of what families across the country are going through? Because everything we outlined is pretty logical, right? Like, I think a reasonable, rational person should be able to understand these nuances and this unique window in time and address them.
Yeah, I think it's that politicians sometimes think in generalities. And so there's this whole thing, and, you know, it's very prevalent in our country, which is sort of we impose deservingness standards on people in terms of whether they're deserving to get help, support from the government or not. And so people are driven by this idea of a work requirement. And the thing is in lots of cases, this actually makes little sense, such as in the case of having a baby. And then another example, Senators Tom Tillis, who's a senator from North Carolina, and Marco Rubio, who's a senator from Florida, recently wrote op-eds talking about this and saying, you know, we need to keep incentivizing work. And an irony to me about that, too, is, you know, two states that are most hardest hit by hurricanes every year would be the states of North Carolina and Florida. And so their pushing in policy would penalize families who have kids with a reduction in their child tax credit because their house got blown away, their job got blown away, or whatever from a hurricane. At the time when people need help the most, they're supporting a policy that actually cuts support and assistance. And it just makes no sense. We know that the costs of raising a child in this country are estimated to be about $250,000. And so the idea that we would, you know, really kick people while they're down, it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But I think it's this, you know, this issue of that they're thinking in generalities rather than, you know, what really do parents and kids need?
No, absolutely. And I think for us and the work that we're building out with our ambassadors program is really trying to almost like help bridge that gap, right? Like having people from across the country reach out to their members or, you know, really even understand these issues just to kind of raise awareness of these issues. Because I do think that families experiencing this does want policy that makes sense and addresses their needs. What do you think people can do to bridge this gap in communication and understanding for listeners and ambassadors across the country?
Yeah, I think the first thing in my mind is that people really do need to center kids in the conversation. I think people do not impose deservingness standards on children in the same way they do other populations. And the fact is, this is called the child tax credit. It should be about the kids and what they need. Babies should not be disproportionately pushed into poverty by the child tax credit. And families with kids do not need to be penalized because they suffered from a natural disaster, you know, whether it's an earthquake, a wildfire, like the wildfires that were swept across the panhandle of Texas recently, or hurricanes. It just makes no sense. And there's other scenarios, right? What if you were in a car accident and you've been hospitalized and were doing rehab for many years, for many months? I mean, you would then suffer from a loss of income and that your child tax credit would be cut. Where, you know, right when you need help the most. So I think that if people really think about it in terms of like real families, real needs, and the real needs of children, then we could move forward on this debate rather than what we're stuck in. And I'm really struck by something that Kristen said in our conversation with her. And I wrote it down and I thought it was really hit home when she said, when we don't have the child tax credit, when we have pay discrimination, when we're pushed out of the workforce, literally, we all lose out. So it's not even about the child or the individual family. It's really about all of us. And research shows that when any of us are doing better, all of us do better. So it's in all of our best interest for every child to be able to thrive. And so I really like that she, you know, focuses on the kids and families, but then really says it really is a societal issue. You know, we really should be supporting the well-being and best interests of children and, you know, not imposing, you know, punitive harm to people when they're down.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that concept of, you know, when you lift up the most marginalized and families and communities that need it the most, by default, everybody does better, right?
Yeah.
But I think that mentality doesn't always translate to policymakers that, you know, especially in this environment when things are just so polarized.
Yeah. So I think the biggest thing that people can do is, you know, they really should call their U.S. senators and their member of Congress and tell them about their needs and the needs of their children. And so why the child tax credit is important and why they need childcare and improved childcare system and funding for their public schools, et cetera, right? Like that's, there's just a disconnect that people really need. We really need to educate policymakers. Well, and right now there's a debate around this bill, HR 7024, and that bill would improve the child tax credit and get rid of these penalties that we impose on families for having babies and babies themselves, and penalties we impose on children in, you know, bigger households. We actually cut funding for families in bigger households. So children in with multiple siblings actually get less money per kid than, you know, a single kid, for example. So those things could be fixed in legislation sending before the U.S. Senate. So it would be really, you know, if people are worried about that, people should call their senators and ask them to support HR 7024, because that legislation would at least alleviate some of the penalties that are currently being imposed by public policy. This is Speaking of Kids. Thanks for listening. I'm Bruce Leslie.
And I'm Misela Jalubi. Special thanks to our guest, Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner.
Speaking of Kids is a podcast by First Focus on Children.
Elizabeth Windham is the supervising producer, and Julia Windham is the associate producer.
Leila Nimitala is the advocacy and mobilizing producer, and the senior producer is Jay Woodward.
Our theme music is Don't Look Twice by Sam Barsh.
For more information about this week's episode, go to firstfocus.org. You can find all of our links in our show notes.
If you have any thoughts, questions, or interest in becoming a First Focus on Children ambassador, email us at speakingofkids@firstfocus.org.
And please follow, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube.
Speaking of Kids is produced by Windhaven Productions and Blue Jay Atlantic.